In 1971, a new product was launched that would disrupt the processed food industry for years to come. The product was called Cup Noodles. Now, curiously enough, in this same year, a future NFL MVP quarterback was born. And then later in his career, he would be stuck in the crossroads as a grocery store worker. And he probably had to swipe these Cup Noodles across as he went. But his fate would change when he met this week's guest, culminating in both of their greatest accomplishments in something called a Super Bowl.
Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. Your host is Arnie Chapman. Football is his passion, and he wants you to come along with him to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board his DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour. Great Scott.
This time as we step off the DeLorean, the date is January 30th, 2000, and we are in Atlanta, Georgia. We've got our fire-burning tires landed in the parking lot of the Georgia Dome. And by golly, there's only a few seconds left on the clock. Super Bowl 34. One more play to go. Steve McNair, he drops back. Kevin Dyson catches the ball over the middle. He's going to score. But wait. There is Mike Jones. He's 1 yard short, and the Rams win the Super Bowl. The city of St. Louis goes wild. The improbable happens. Kurt Warner, undrafted bag boy, cut by the Packers. Then he joins the Arena Football League, dominates, sent to NFL Europe by the Rams, dominates again. Trent Green goes down, dominates. They win the Super Bowl. And there was at least one person that never wavered. He believed in his players and ultimately also believed that Kurt Warner could take him to the promised land. This guy was head coach Dick Vermeil. Now, this was not his first NFL gig, nor was it the first time he went to the Super Bowl. Coach Vermeil was successful at every level as a coach, and his career just speaks for himself. And speaking for himself, he shall in this week's episode, because we're honored to have a Super Bowl winning head coach ride shotgun with us in the DeLorean. He's going to share his incredible story about a long career that involved not only coaching, but also broadcasting. And now he's also a mentor for many out there, one of the greatest leaders in NFL history. And I'll go ahead and leave links in the show notes for you so you can learn more about Coach Vermeil and maybe even purchase some of his wine. We'll talk about that later in the episode, which, by the way, you can get to the show notes through your podcast player or by heading to thefootballhistorydude.com. Again, that's thefootballhistorydude.com. It's the best place to go to get even more information about these topics and guests that I bring on the show. Also, if you'd like to get more involved and help out the show, you can support the show in various ways. You can review the show on all your podcast players. You can subscribe for free. You could even offer a donation or even get some merchandise. Again, that's over at the website, thefootballhistorydude.com. But without further ado, let's get into the interview with Coach Dick Vermeil. Hey, Coach, welcome to the show. Welcome to the Football History Dude Podcast.
Nice to be with you.
Nice to be with you as well. And I was trying to figure out how I wanted to start with so many questions because you've been in the NFL and you've been in sport or football for a long time. I just had to start at the beginning. What drove you from an early age? Do you remember a specific moment where you were like, you know what, I really enjoy this football and I think I might want to do this for a living, or something that sparked your passion?
Well, you know, I grew up in a small town of 1,800 people. You know, we had 130 kids in our high school. And the football team, to have a team, everybody had to play. Okay. In my senior year, a new coach came, just graduated from University of Pacific, was called College of Pacific at that time in Stockton. And it was his first head coaching job. And he inspired me. You know, he was a great example in everything he did. He had a lot of passion for the game. He taught me a lot. And he was the first one that ever said to me, you know, Vermeil, if you decided you wanted to, you could probably play Division I football. No one had ever told me that before, and I didn't have that kind of expectation. I wasn't planning on going to college. I was going to work in my dad's garage. We were going to build a new shop, Vermeil and Sons Owl Garage. You know, I was going to fool around with his race cars and go that way. But this coach saying I could play college football, I said, great. But he said, you know, you haven't been doing anything in school. So you're going to have to go to junior college to catch up. So I did. I went to Napa College and played there 2 years and walked on at San Jose State and earned a scholarship there and ended up starting my senior year, stayed there and got my master's degree. Then Bob Bronson, who was my head football coach there my first year there, so I really started talking to me because he saw that I had a very sincere interest in the game beyond playing it. And he said, you know, I think you would make a fine football coach with all your excitement and passion for the game and how you love to talk about it at this age. And I said, well, that's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to try to be a high school football coach. So lo and behold, he got me a head coaching job at Hillsdale High School. I 1 year as an assistant at Del Mar. This is Dr. Robert Bronson calls me up. My college coach, he says, a gentleman from Hillsdale High School in San Mateo is going to call you and offer you the head coaching job there. Now, you're going to have to coach the swimming team too, but I would take it. It's a good opportunity for a young coach. Lo and behold, it happened. I became a head high school football coach my second year out, won a championship, went to junior college as an assistant for a year, and then I had an opportunity to go as a head coach in junior college, so I took it. I was there a season. We had a good season, and I got a call from John Ralston at Stanford and invited me to be the freshman coach at Stanford. Said, God, that's a great opportunity. And from there on, each job just sort of blossomed out of that environment, you know, out of that start.
Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we know that you culminated in the NFL, and that's one reason why I brought you on the show, because this is a history podcast mostly revolving around the NFL. And speaking of NFL coaches, and you said you kind of fell in and you kind of just blossomed into new different opportunities. Were you ever a student of the game, or like really dove into previous coaches before your time and kind of studied how they did things?
I was a student of the game in the present, not so much in the past. A student in the game and learning from the people I started working for, like John Ralston, you know. And then I'd go from working with John Ralston, I'd go working with George Allen, Los Angeles Rams, as his first special teams coach. And he had a lot of great coaches on his staff. Ted Marshall, Broda, Howard Snellenberger, Ray Malavasi, these kind of guys. I was learning every day I went to work. And then I had the opportunity to go to UCLA and work for Tommy Prothrow, who was a great legendary college coach and be his offensive coordinator. So I left and went there. Fortunately, I did. He gets hired the next year to go back to the Rams to be the head coach. So I went back to the Rams with him as the offensive coordinator, stayed there. We all got fired. They asked me to stay. And then Chuck Knox took the head coaching job. And, you know, I learned from him and Tom Catlin and those kind of guys on that staff. And it was a never ending process, you know, and along the way, Bill Walsh was the reason I got the freshman job at Stanford. He was working there, and he was a graduate assistant at San Jose when I played there. So we had a friendship, and we started sharing thoughts and ideas. And, of course, he was brighter than I am, and I learned a lot from him. And then, lo and behold, I get called to come back to UCLA to be the head coach. So I go back there, and I had a great coaching staff there, Terry Donahue, Dick Tomey, Carl Peterson, Lynn Stiles, all these guys, Billy Matthews, Bill McPherson, who just recently passed away, God bless him. And then I got the head coaching job at the Philadelphia Eagles. So, and then I'm in a situation where I'm learning from Tom Landry, you know, Don Coryell, Don Shula, Bud Grant, all these legendary coaches as you coach against them.
Right, yeah, and you mentioned Bill Walsh, for instance, and he's known to have a brilliant mind. If you could try to describe it in one sentence or something like that, how would you describe his mind and how he thought about the game?
Well, I think Bill's number one attribute, he was able to make complicated things simple to learn. And he knew exactly what he had to do to coach it, how many repetitions it would take to execute it well. But he could visualize things, break it down so players could learn it easily, even though it wasn't simple, but he could take complicated things and work his timing scheme and all that in it, and obviously became very, very successful building on that pattern of education, of educating his players and coaching them. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's important for any kind of level of training or learning or teaching. Is, for instance, even in our schools, the teachers that are able to take complex algorithms and break them down to the students, be able to explain it in their terms in a way that they can get to their level. It just makes it so then everybody's on the same page. And
no question.
I appreciate that from coaches. Yeah. So I've had multiple coaches myself, opposite, some that have been no, this is my way. You're going to learn it or you don't. And then I've had the other ones that have taught me the other ways, and definitely gravitated towards the ones that were willing to break it down to the level and everybody on the same page. You mentioned,
well, you know, I always laugh. People always ask me, this new coach I just hired in the league is really smart. And I said, that'll only help him if he can coach.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of X's and O's, but it's the people that make a difference.
And you can teach, you know, you have that communication skill.
Yeah. And speaking of that too, you speak a lot, don't you, at conventions or for business?
I have. I am not, you know, I don't get invited as much anymore. But, you know, at 83 years old, they go with the younger people, but I enjoy it. I invest a lot of time, and I spent 35 years coaching the game and working as a leader, and I put together a presentation that I use. It's all written word for word. I don't present it as a word to word thing, but I really enjoy it because it's stimulating to me. I try to stay up with the thinking as of today and learn from it and add it to my philosophy of the past and try to do a good job. I enjoy it. I had 3 events scheduled, but due to the virus, they were postponed or canceled.
Right, right. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's a common theme across the nation and the world right now. Yeah. But I appreciate you taking the time out here to, you know, we're digitally or we're digital nomads being able to have an interview.
Well, believe me, you're not occupying real valuable time right now. We're out here hibernating. I live out in the country on 110 acres of farmland.
You
can see by my outfit, I'm outside working as we speak. I just came in to do this. So I didn't get dressed up.
Okay. Right, no, but again, I appreciate it. I mean, everybody has the things that they're trying to do in life. And I always appreciate anybody that's willing to give me any point in their time, especially even the listeners of the show, because they could listen or they could consume any kind of content, but they decided for that hour to listen to what I'm going to talk about and speak. Let's go with football, and you talk about leadership. Do you have anybody throughout your history? Like, who did you emulate, or who really was your mentors to help you with that side of the game as far as working with people?
Well, you know, I worked with so many different people. I think everybody influenced me, and those that I didn't agree with in their approach and leadership, then it just didn't fit my personality. That doesn't make them wrong. But you know, I didn't change my leadership from Hillsdale High School to the Super Bowl team or the Kansas City Chiefs playoff teams. You know, you had to be yourself. You know, and the only way you can truly be trusted and respected is be honest, be sincere, and be yourself. And I couldn't be Bill Walsh if I wanted to. He couldn't be Dick Vermeil, but I could be myself. But you do learn from everybody. You take, you know, Chuck Knox was a very positive influence in terms of just leadership skill. Very intense, very easy to understand, very hard to misunderstand. John Ralston was a good communicator, great home visit recruiter, family recruiter. You know, George Allen had a great passionate way of selling. You know, he was very compassionate with his players. And all these people influenced my leadership. But basically, I think my leadership skills come from the left side of my brain. You know, I know I'm not a bragger or ego guy, but I always felt that I could easily communicate with people and I could understand what they were saying and I could learn from them and I could learn what I didn't want to learn from them and improve what I thought had to be improved and remain humble and move on, you know, and I think that's very critical in leadership.
Yeah, I agree. And you don't have to be. You can remain humble and you're not bragging by any means, because we have seen it as fans that how you've been able to instill the passion, the I want to follow the leader type of mentality with your players and that kind of thing. And you've had success, of course, at multiple levels of the game, high school, junior, college, and then professional. What was the biggest change going from each level, like as a coach perspective, like what was the biggest challenge?
Well, a long time ago, John Ralston, when I was a young assistant at Stanford with Bill Walsh and Jim Mora, he said to me, you know, he said it to all of you guys, you know, someday you guys are going to be head coaches, and you're never as ready for a head coaching job as you think you are. And the only way to really get ready is to get the job and learn on the fly. And that was so true. I wasn't ready to be the head coach at 23 years old at Hillsdale High School, but you learn on the fly, you get going and you win, you move on. Same in college, same at UCLA. Was I ready to be a head coach at Division I at that? Probably not. But I learned a lot. I learned a lot. You know, by just going to work, mm-hmm. and then on into college, all the way into pro football, and from coordinators' jobs to head coaching jobs at three different places. You learn a little bit. I was probably best prepared, totally prepared to be a head coach when I went to Kansas City Chiefs in 2001. And Carl Peterson brought me back after I left the Rams. And I really felt confident. You know, I know how to do it now. And it didn't turn out as well as it did at the Rams or Philadelphia, but it turned out well. You know what? And if I were to do it today, I think I could do it better, though physically you probably couldn't last the season at 83 years old like you could even in your 60s. But to me, leadership qualities now are as critical as technical knowledge about the game. You can always hire people who know a little more than you do in specific areas. I've learned what's really important is know the main things. Like I always used to say, the main thing is the main thing. That's the win. But you have to know what you have to have a vision of how you want to win and then put that vision together. And it always starts with hiring good people that care, that are good examples, that are build relationships, that are willing to go to work. I spent a lot of time trying to teach people that hard work is not a form of punishment. You know, it's a necessity. And I just know there's no correlation between working less and getting better. So my whole philosophy was built around surround yourself with good people and go to work together.
Yeah, and you kind of touched on this a little bit, but one of the questions I ask every guest of the show is taking them back to the beginning of their career. But for you, let's say the beginning of your NFL career, what piece of advice would you have given your however old self that was at that point in time with all this experience you've had since then?
Listen to the people that you respect and admire. Listen to them. I became a poor listener. Not in regard to X's and O's, but in regard to, hey, you can't keep working 20 hours a day during the season and sleep in your office. It's going to catch up with you. You know, and I wouldn't listen to him. I didn't listen to Sid Gilman. I didn't listen to Lynn Styles. I didn't listen to Carl Peterson. I didn't listen to my owners, my pro football team in Philadelphia. You said you're going to work yourself out of the business, which I did. You know, I allowed a passion for the game to become an obsession, and I couldn't turn it off. And therefore, I wasn't as effective a football coach or as effective a leader. I couldn't get over a loss, and a win didn't last very long in terms of excitement. So, you know, it was a lesson learned, but if I would have really listened to the people, they told me I couldn't do it. But, and it wasn't an ego thing. I just didn't believe them.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to do when you're in something and just, it's always, my grandpa always says, listen with your ears, not your mouth, son. And that's how, I guess, it's pretty common, but it's hard to really do that. And that's why I think separates a lot of the good leaders from the ones that have challenges. And you mentioned the first time you retired and you were burned out, then you went into broadcasting for, it was quite some time. How many years were you in there for?
14 years. I worked with a lot of great guys. I learned a lot of football. For 5 years, I was on a college football field 90% of the time. When you're broadcasting national games, there are always big games, big teams, good coaches. Then in the NFL, I was in the NFL for 5 years doing it 90% of the time. Then college football for 9 years doing it. That's what it was. And a big time game with Brent Musburger and, you know, Gary Bender and these kind of guys. All great, you know, great guys. Roger Twible. I learned a lot from watching the coaches coach. Great football coaches. I've sat in Don Shula's meeting rooms, top Bud Grant's. All these, and watch them coach, and then on into college, watch, you know, Osborne's, and probably Bill Snyder, Tom Coughlin. Bill Snyder and Tom Coughlin were probably the two finest football coaches I watched coach on a field. And you learn from those guys. And by the time I decided to go back into coaching, first I found out that not everything I did was wrong. Some of the things I did was really good, and I learned some better things from other better coaches by being in broadcasting, being in their meeting rooms, being on their practice field, studying their game films, and working with the likes of Brent Musburger.
Yeah, I would think you're able to take it from a whole nother perspective and then be able to apply those new skills and things that you've learned into your second stint, I'll say, in the NFL. Yeah. And you mentioned Tom Coughlin was one of the best on-field coaches.
Oh, yeah, by far.
What would be maybe a specific example or type of event that would cause him to be that in your mind?
Well, he's a strong leader. very structured, extremely well-disciplined, had extremely well-disciplined football teams in every category, in a meeting room, on the practice field, fundamentally, technically, execution, under pressure. I saw him beat teams he had no business beating, but because he and his coaching staff did an outstanding job. You know, Tom Osborne was outstanding. Now, Bill Snyder at Kansas State was as good as the best, if he wasn't the best. You know, it just, when you walk on the practice field, it looked like game day. They executed, worked so hard, so disciplined, and the scout teams servicing the home team in getting ready to play on that weekend, you couldn't tell them from the starting team. They were so, you know, everything is extremely well done. And they leave great impressions. Don Shula, you talk about a commander-in-chief on football field. Bud Grant was totally different. He walked on the field very relaxed and laid back in it, but everybody knew where he was coming from. He didn't have to say much. Bill Parcells, my God, you know, all these guys, I watched them coach, talk to them in their meeting rooms after I left coaching, you know, in 82. And the likes of Joe Gibbs, you know, you really get to know these guys. When you've been a coach, now you're in broadcasting their games and you talk with them, talk football. You talk about what I did wrong, some of the things I did right. I learned from them. So it's a great way to make, it's stealing for a living.
Right, yeah. It's almost like you have a different, almost like a brotherhood with them. So I wonder if willing to share more with you or in a different light than they would someone else.
Certain coaches, you know, for example, Don Shula, when I went in to broadcast one of his pro games, he wouldn't let anybody in television on the practice field or in a meeting. I was the only one. Why? Because he'd beaten my butt a few times. He said he can't be that good. So he just gave me free reign to prepare to present his game on that Sunday. And I found that often amongst new coaches. It's a fraternity for the most part. I don't know if it's the same way today where you sort of protected each other because you're all being over-evaluated and you're all in situations you're going to be criticized and ridiculed. And, and when you all go through it, you know what it's like. So you support each other loyalty-wise.
And you mentioned you don't know exactly because you're not in it right now, but what does it mean to Dick Vermeil to be a coach at any level, regardless of what we're talking about, even regardless of sport?
Well, I think all of us have to recognize what our gift may be. A lot of people go through life and don't find what their gift is, so they just make a living. You know, and I found that I had a great passion for the game. I found I had a tremendous compassion for the kids that I was coaching. And I found that going to work wasn't a way to make a living. It was a way to enjoy a living. Going to work was exciting. Now, when I allowed that to overpower me in 81, 82, when it really started coming on, that wasn't true. That's why I left coaching, because I knew I wasn't doing as good a job as I should be doing.
So you left 81, 82, went into broadcasting, and you came back with, which most of us remember you and my generation as the St. Louis Rams. What drove you to do that at that point in time?
Well, the St. Louis Rams were the Los Angeles Rams. I'd worked for them and that ownership as a young assistant. They knew me. They had offered me the job, the opportunity to come and be their head coach at other times earlier that when it was open, and I wouldn't do it. And finally, at 60, 61 years old, I said, if I don't do it now, it'll be way too late and no one else is going to offer me a job. So I took it. Thank you to Georgia Frontier and John Shaw and Jay Sigmund. And in 3 years, we got the job done. I went home, which was a mistake. I don't sit here and regret it. No, I wish I hadn't done it. But, you know, I'm an emotional guy, sometimes too emotional. And I thought it was the right thing to do career-wise and for my family and for me personally. So I went home. And I found out 6 months later, actually, when I was handing out the Super Bowl rings at the party, what did I do? You know,
yeah, that's
Carl Peterson at the Chiefs and Lamar Hunt came and talked me into taking that job.
Now, again, going back to my remembrance of that Super Bowl and at the very end, and you holding your, I believe it was your grandkids and saying, we've done it, we did it. And what was that emotion being able to go through that and share that with your family at that time?
Well, that, you know, that kind of emotion is hard to put into words, especially if you're not an English major, you know. But I would say it, to me, it was humbling. And it became, it was never about me anyway. I never put myself as a leader. It's all about me. And you guys just follow me. It was always about my team, my players, my staff, and my people. And then when you accomplish something like that, for me, that thought permeated me more than it ever had in my lifetime. It was very humbling and a great feeling to know that I was sharing this experience right now with the city of St. Louis, all my personal family, all my personal friends, everybody in my organization, all my team. And these moments will never be forgotten. They are lifetime thoughts, and they're great examples of what can be done when people all work together. And I know a lot of people on my team and my coaching staff that I continually communicate with on a weekly basis, a lot of them, that they use that as an example for the rest of their lives and pattern it. You know, if you surround yourself with good people and go to work, you can win a lot of games.
Yeah, and of course, again, going back to my history, it was one of those moments that so many people in the nation wanted to root for your team because of you had to overcome some obstacles, of course. I mean, that's no secret with Trent Green going down and then Kurt Warner coming up. It was different then for after that. How watching your team on the field against the Patriots and the first time they won, what was that like? You know, oh man, I wanted to be there kind of thing.
Are you talking about the Super Bowl game that Rams lost?
Yes. How was it?
Stands watching the game and I felt as bad as Mike Martz did in losing it. You know, and because all those players, 90% of we brought there in the 3 years that I was there. So I felt sorry for them. Because they were still, yes, ex-players, but most of them all good friends.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, you feel it. You know, you don't feel it like you would if you were coaching the team. But still, you know what it feels like to lose. And no one can appreciate a Super Bowl win as much as they should unless they lost one.
Mm-hmm. Then right. You
have something to compare it with. I've learned over the years to recognize it takes the same thing to get to a Super Bowl game and lose as it does to get there and win. You know, it's not like baseball and Major League Basketball where it's the best series of seven. You know, lose the first one, you got six to go. No, that's not true. So, in fact, my Eagle team did more to get there and lose in 5 years than my Ramted team did to get there in 3 years and win. But it's just, you only had that one opportunity.
When you were in that moment, did it pause for you, or did you like get that how people feel in the movies where it's like I paused, I'm looking around, and I have this like...
Yeah, my first thought, I've seen pictures, fans send me that picture. I get two or three a week of the exact same picture, me raising my hands. And at that time, I was saying, it's over. We are world champions. And that, you know, and that's the I think, probably the finest statement you can make in an NFL coaching career. You only get to say it when you win it.
Right, yeah. And there's
always... You've never won it before, and you'd lost it before. Hey, we are world champions. No one else can say that.
Yeah, and as a Detroit Lions fan, I haven't had to have that bitter loss defeat kind of feeling. Of course,
I like their coach.
You like it? So, do you go ahead and speak a little bit about him for me? Then
I like his structure. You know, yeah, I think he makes people mad. You know, I've always been a believer. When you take over, I've taken three losing teams over. Two of them were the worst losing teams in football when we took them over: the Eagles and the Rams. You're always going to make people mad. And you're going to make them worse before they get better. You're going to lose a few good players. You're going to develop some players that no one thought were any good. And you build on that. But you don't do it unless you have structure, discipline. And losing teams lose because more often than not because they don't have any structure. They don't have a discipline. They don't have an intense program. They go from day to day trying to win games rather than trying to build a program. This kid comes from a great program led by Belichick. No one has ever done it better. He knows how to do it. And I think if they're patient with him and he has the inner leadership skills, I think he'll get it done.
Yeah, as a D2 Detroit Lions lifer fan. I hope so as well. And you mentioned building a team, and of course it takes time, and I'm patient myself. When you're a coach, and what quality or qualities were the most important for you when you looked into getting a new player?
Well, you know, every position's different. You always start with character, and then from then on, you know what it takes to play all the great positions, you know, and play it well. So you look for those attributes of other great players. I've coached a ton of guys that are in the Hall of Fame, and two going in this year, two wide receivers going in this year, Harold Carmichael, Isaac Bruce, both different style, but I know what their attributes were. And you can, once you've been around them, and you can visualize what they look like and remember what they look like, then you start looking at younger people that have aspirations to play like these guys do. You can sometimes really say, hey, this guy's got it, or this guy's doesn't have what Isaac Bruce has. You know, he doesn't have what Torrey Holt has. He doesn't have what Harold Carmichael has, or he doesn't have what Trent Green has, or he doesn't have what Kurt Warner has. He doesn't have what Orlando Pace or Willie Rofe has, you know, but you can make a comparison. You don't forget good example. You forget good opinions, but you very seldom forget good examples.
And you mentioned this year Hall of Fame, and this is the centennial, so they're going to bring up more than they typically would. You were in the game for quite some time. What was the biggest change as far as the NFL over your career, you think, as far as either the style of play or whatever it may be?
Well, two things have changed dramatically from when I came into the league in 1969, and I was head coach in the Eagles in 76 through 82. But during that period, and even coming back to the Rams in 97, all the way to the Chiefs, and to today, I'd say there's more great big fast guys playing the game. The game is more wide open and spread out. The volume of what you see offensively is tenfold of what you used to see. The defenses are much more sophisticated. You can do more. I liken it to if you bought a 1980 Cadillac, like our Super Bowl team. Well, hell, our Super Bowl team was a Cadillac team. We're in the biggest game. Okay, we're in that category. But that same Cadillac isn't nearly the car in comparison to the 2020 Cadillac. The whole thing is more sophisticated. How it's prepared, how it's manufactured, how it's coached, how it's disciplined, how the game is played, how it's officiated, how the rules, it's all changed. It's all bigger, faster, more money involved in it by far. So it's hard to compare. The grassroots fundamentals, I think, were better in the old days in a lot of ways because you spent more time with the individual player. Now you spend more time on volume. Less time on contact, that's controlled by the union. Less time on the practice field, that's controlled by the players' union. So all those things are different. The game itself, though, is far more sophisticated, far more wide open.
It may be more sophisticated and wide open. And one of the questions that I ask every guest of the show, too, is I'm going to give you the keys to my DeLorean. You can go back in time to any point in NFL history, preferably maybe before your time in the league. So you can be there, present, and observe, but you can't change the outcome. What moment, game, person are you going to go see?
Well, I probably enjoyed the 70-80 era myself as a coach more because I was younger. I was my head coach. I had full control, 51% of everything done with a football player. I coached my own quarterbacks. I was my own offensive coordinator. I called my own plays. After being out for 14 years and coming back and taking the Ram job in 1997, I couldn't do that anymore. I was out of the game too long. And I missed that part. And I had to be careful I didn't screw up people and interject too much of the old ways of doing things. And I had to do a better job of making sure the environment was great for my coaches to coach in. The discipline was great so the players are in a frame of mind to be coached. And I had it organized in detail so they could coach successfully. I loved that era because it was 10-man coaching staff. I had the largest coaching staff in football with 10 guys.
Hmm.
10 guys, okay. No one had that many coaches. So I had an advantage. Why? I had 10 guys at UCLA and we won the Rose Bowl. I need 10 guys. I didn't think I ever would need 20 like I had in my last career job. But anyway, that's my thinking.
Yeah, it's definitely changed. Of course, from the coaching, players, everything, technology, even the coverage. I mean, I'm on a podcast talking about the NFL, where that would have never even been heard of during your first time with the league. So you've been with the NFL, then after you've gotten out, or maybe even before, the Vermeil Wines, what was your passion there?
You know, first off, I needed something to do. And I grew up in the Napa Valley, north end of the Napa Valley, Calistoga. Everybody there was in the vineyard business or the prune business when I was a kid. My grandfather, Vermeil, made all our own wines. He's the Frenchman. My Italian great-grandfather brought the family to the Napa Valley, and he was in the wine business and owned some of the vineyard that I get grapes from today. And I used to help my grandfather Vermeil make our wines when I was capable, and I always maintained a passion for it. And then in 1999, I went to some of my friends that still lived in the Napa Valley that were in the wine business and say, can we make some Jean-Louis Vermeil Cabernet? That was my dad's name. That was my great-grandfather's name. I'd like to put their name on a wine bottle because wine was so important to our family. And he said, sure, I'll do it. So he made 150, 200 cases a year and sold it as his Cabernet out of On the Edge Winery. Paul Smith did a great job with it. We did that until 2008. Some friends with real hard money came and said, let's take your process, your people, and turn it into a full-fledged business. We did. Now we're making 2,500 cases a year. We've matured. Paul Smith is still a partner, but not our winemaker anymore. Thomas Rivers Brown, who is the Tom Brady winemaker in the Napa Valley, and Andy Jones make our wines. Our wines are not inexpensive. 2,500 cases of wine, you got to make good wine. A lot tougher than the NFL. NFL's got 32 teams. We got over 500 wineries in the Napa Valley you're competing with. But we make very good wine, and they only get better. And I enjoy it. I enjoy it. It's a tough business. Right now, due to the virus, our tasting room in Napa is closed. Our wine club can get their wines. We have about 375 members in our wine club now that get shipments three times a year. People that love good wine, just Google Vermeil Wines. They're not overly priced, and they will compete with wines that you're paying more for. I promise you.
Well, that's cool that you have a passion that was, like you said, I didn't know it was driven from a family based. And I think that's cool that you're able to honor, you know, like you said, your grandfather with the name there too. And you said that, was he your father part of the wine business then too? Or was
my
that
grandfather?
Oh, great.
My father's grandfather on the Italian side of his family was in Calistoga on business on a part-time basis. He was very successful in San Francisco, made money. He was from Tuscany area, Lucca, Italy, Lucca Barga, actually. And Napa Valley reminded him of that area. So he started buying properties, including the home I was born in. It's still there. It's a great heritage. And I respect it. I salute it by being in the wine business. And having a Vermeil name on a wine label is not an ego thing with me. It's actually more work than I thought it would be. It's actually tougher than I thought it would be.
Sure.
If I lived out there in Calistoga, it would be a lot easier to be successful. But we haven't made the playoffs yet, I'll tell you that. Only in quality of wine.
Well, there you go. You have something to strive for. And Coach, well, is there anything else that you have to share with the fans of the show?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to talk football. I don't get it as much as I'd like to anymore. And I miss it. But, I enjoy it. I really miss Sunday football right now, especially during this hibernation period we're all in. Nothing to watch on Sunday afternoon really gets me. But anyway, good luck to you. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you, too, sir. And you have yourself a good day.
Take care.
How about that? Coach Vermeil. Man, he's just such a good guy. I'm thankful that he was able to take time from working in his yard to come out and give us an interview. An extremely knowledgeable guy, a coach, a leader on the field, but even off the field. He had a way, unlike many other types of coaches, and I believe that his players really did grasp onto that type of leadership and coaching style, and just they wanted to go to battle for him. Of course, they wanted to go to battle for the team, but they wanted to go for the coach, and they wanted to win, which they ultimately did. Super Bowl 34, Kurt Warner and the Rams taking it home for St. Louis. But this week's My Favorite Football Moment comes from Jimmy Grant. He says that the Dick Vermeil era in Philadelphia was his favorite as an Eagles fan. Take it away, Jimmy.
My name is Jimmy Grant. I'm a huge Philadelphia Eagles fan. This one's easy for me. 1980, Wilbert Montgomery's 42-yard run on the Eagles' second play from scrimmage to set the Eagles off and running on their way to the NFC Championship. Might be because I was a kid. You're nostalgic for that time period, but what a run. And it's a moment that no matter, the Eagles could win 10 Super Bowls, but the 1980 Eagles will remain my favorite Eagles team of all time. Pat Summerall with the call.
Thanks, Jimmy. And I tell you what, here's another one sent in by Gary Jajora. Now, I wish we had a recording, but there's other ways for you to send in your favorite football moment, because if you want to do the same thing, you can. You can just fill out the contact form. This is what Gary did. I kind of wish he did send a recording, because this is a guy from down under. But let's just say, maybe I shouldn't butcher it and use his accent. I'm just going to read it verbatim. Here we go. Quote, "My favorite moment was filming my Miami Dolphins team at their training facility doing candid camera stuff with them. It was back in 2003 and got to take photos with their two Lombardis. Love you all to check out my comical book, NFL Clichés, available at NFLClichés.com. End quote. And speaking of his book, I'll go ahead and include links to that in the show notes for you as well. And if you're interested in sharing your favorite football moment, or even maybe you got to state your case for someone you think should be in the Hall of Fame, you can head over to myfootballmoment.com for the details. But for now, dudes, I'm through if you're through.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Football History Dude. To make sure you're the first to get the next episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice and head on over to thefootballhistorydude.com for the show notes and more information on the history of the NFL. And remember, dudes, where we're going, we don't need roads.